The University of Edinburgh, this is the informatics colloquium from the School of Informatics, is proud to present this man whose commitment to freedom and free software has been unswerving and helped the software community accomplish so much. In return, for you, the audience, we ask three things, three very simple things. Please do not confuse the terms open source and free software. They're different things. Please don't confuse the terms patents and copyright. They're different things. And when referring to the kernel Linux or the GNU project working together to be the operating system which millions of people have, say GNU Linux. Can we agree to do this?
We'll try.
Do we have agreement? If you don't understand, listen carefully to the talk and search the web afterwards. And now, Richard Stallman.
Please raise your hands if you cannot hear me. Sometimes I say that and people raise their hands. It makes me really wonder. Developing the GNU operating system was and is a technical project. But unlike most technical projects, its purpose is not technical. And the subject of this talk is not technical. It's about a social, ethical, and political question. What should the rules of society be for using software? Most of the time, when people address that question, they work for software companies, and they address it from a self-serving direction. They ask themselves, what rules can we impose on everybody else to make them pay us a lot of money? I'm sure you've heard the answers that they come up with. But I had the good fortune in the 1970s to be part of a community of programmers who shared software. And because of that experience, I was led to look at the same question from a different direction, to ask what kinds of rules make for a good society, good for all the people in it. And so I was led to completely different answers. And that's the basis of the free software movement. That's what this talk is about. I should start by saying a little about that community. It included programmers at some of the best universities, and even programmers in computer companies sometimes participated. And within this community, if you wrote a program, you'd share it. That was our way of life. It was shocking on those rare occasions when anybody didn't share a program. We thought it was weird. The lab where I worked, the Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT, was in a way the deepest part of this community because there our entire operating system had been developed by programmers in the community. It was free software. We called it the Incompatible Timesharing System, or ITS for short. So in this lab, all the software we used was free software. We'd share everything. If you walk past another hacker's screen, that's what we called ourselves, hackers, and you saw something strange on it, you'd say, hey, what is that? And he'd tell you, oh, that's the new FUBAR program which we just got from Stanford, and it's in the FUBAR directory. So at that point, in the FUBAR directory, you'd find the executable that you could run, and also the source code, which you could read and study to see how they solved those problems, so you could learn from the program as well. In running the program, you'd probably encounter bugs and have ideas for new features. So you could go to the source code and fix the bugs, add new features, make whatever changes seemed useful to make. You could even cut out a piece of that source code and put it into some other programming you were writing, and this was something we often did. We called it cannibalizing the old program, which was a joke, because unlike cannibalizing a machine for spare parts, copying parts of a program does not make it non-operational. you're just copying, not destroying it. And that's a very important thing to realize. Copying a program doesn't destroy or damage it in any way. So in this community, a program would be developed by one person after another over the years, sometimes over the course of decades. And so our system grew the way a city grows. You'd see some lines of code which by their style you could recognize, oh, those must go back to the 1960s. Real ancient code. And other parts look new and you could tell that they had been recently rewritten. But then we got a taste of what life was like for most computer users, the ones who were not part of a community like ours. This happened when Xerox gave MIT a laser printer. This was actually the first time anybody outside Xerox had a laser printer. It was the first generation laser printer, actually a high-speed office copier that had been modified to turn it into a printer. And in some ways it worked very well. It printed a page a second, it had high resolution, and straight lines came out perfectly straight. But it also had problems. It got frequent paper jams. Perhaps as a copier, those paper jams weren't so bad because there would have been somebody nearby who would notice and fix it. But the printer, as a printer, it suffered greatly from this because it would stay jammed for a long time. Nobody's office was very near the printer. When we noticed that this was a frequent problem, we thought about how to do something about it. And of course, we thought of trying to solve this problem the way we had done it for our old printer. See, the old printer was slow and low resolution, and straight lines tended to come out a bit wavy. And also, it got paper jams. There was nothing we could do to make the printer itself print any better, because we were programmers, not printer engineers. But instead, we thought of ways to change the software to compensate, partly, for the shortcomings of the printer. For instance, there was a feature that every time the printer finished a file, the system would display a message on the screen of the user who printed that file, saying, "Your file foo has been printed." So you had to wait because the printer was slow, but you didn't have to wait extra while you were trying to guess whether your file was printed. And there was another feature that I recall I added, which was when the printer got jammed or ran out of something, the system displayed a message for every user currently waiting for printing, saying, "The printer is in trouble, go fix it." Now, if you got that message, you would know that only a few people were going to get that message, so you wouldn't bet that somebody else would fix the problem. That was too risky. You would go to the printer immediately. So the printer still got jammed and still ran out of paper or toner, but a minute later, two or three people would come and they would fix it. In effect, we kept the printer running smoothly by adding end-to-end feedback, by treating the user as part of the system. We got reliable operation for the whole system, even though the printer component was not reliable. Well, that was well and good, and when we saw that the new printer got paper jams frequently, we thought of trying to solve this problem the same way. But there we ran into a stone wall. We were able to add these features for the old printer because it was controlled by a free program, a program that belonged to the community. We had the source code. We could make changes, limited only by our skill as programmers in doing so. But the new printer was controlled by a proprietary program. We did not have the source code, and that meant we were helpless. We were prisoners of our software. We couldn't make any, no matter how small. And the result was constant frustration. You'd type the command to print a file and go back to work, knowing that even though the printer was fast, you shouldn't expect to get your output soon. A while later, you'd notice the time. Oh, it's been half an hour. Not worth going there yet. So you go back to work, and a while later, you notice the time again. Oh, it's been an hour. Maybe it's printed now. So you go upstairs to the printer, and you see it's been jammed the whole time. So you fix it, and you go back to work, and a while later, you notice the time. Oh, it's been another half hour. Maybe it's printed now. So you go upstairs, and you see it printed 200 pages of other people's stuff, which was 3.5 minutes for this fast printer, and then jammed again. And at that point, you'd say, I'm going to stand here and fix this damn thing every time it jams until I see my output come out. The worst possible operation. And what made this all the more galling every time was to realize that we could have solved this problem, but somebody in Xerox was deliberately keeping us helpless. Now, they had given us a very handsome and unusual and expensive gift in that printer. I couldn't say that they owed it to us to do the work to add these features, but they shouldn't have been standing in our way when we wanted to do the work. Then I heard that somebody at Carnegie Mellon had a copy of that source code. Eventually, I was there, so I went to his office and said, Hi, I'm from MIT. Could I have a copy of the printer software source code? And he said, No, I promised not to give you a copy. I was not just angry, I was stunned. And I couldn't think of a way to adequately express my anger, not that minute. All I could think of was to walk out of his room without saying one more word to him. And because I hadn't expressed my anger, perhaps, I kept thinking about it afterward. Of course, there was the printer to remind me. And because I thought about it, That was very useful for me. You see, his refusal to cooperate with his colleagues at MIT was very bad for us because we never got that source code and we were never able to solve these problems for all the time we kept using that printer for all the years. But in an indirect way, it was very good for me because thinking about the ethics of what he had done taught me an important lesson. A lesson that's all the more important because most programmers and computer users don't learn it. You see, he had promised to refuse to cooperate with me and all of his colleagues at MIT. But he didn't just do that to us. Chances are he did it to you as well. And I'd say he probably did it to you too. And, probably you as well. In fact, he probably promised to refuse to cooperate with quite a number of you, the exceptions being those of you who were not yet born at the time, who were not therefore included in his promise, because he had promised to deny his cooperation to just about all of humanity. Including probably all of you who were alive at the time. He had signed a non-disclosure agreement. This was my first direct encounter with a non-disclosure agreement. I was the victim. I and my whole lab were the victims. And the lesson it taught me was that non-disclosure agreements have victims. They're not innocent. They are not harmless. They're really doing wrong to people, lots of people. Most people who use a computer first encounter a non-disclosure agreement when they're invited to sign one. And there's always some kind of goodie that they're going to. So they make up excuses to close their eyes to the wrong that they are doing. they say to themselves, he'll never be able to get a copy anyway, so why shouldn't I join the conspiracy to deprive him? They say to themselves, this is the way it's always done. Who am I to go against it? They say to themselves, if I don't sign this, somebody else will. Various excuses to gag their consciences. But when somebody invited me to sign a non-disclosure agreement, I had already experienced being the victim and being very angry. So my conscience was already sensitized, and I could not turn around and do the same wrong to unknown numbers of people who had done no wrong to me. So I said, thank you for offering me this nice software package, but I cannot in good conscience accept the conditions you have set, so I will do without it, no thanks. And so I have never knowingly signed a non-disclosure agreement for generally useful technical information such as software. Now, there are other kinds of information which raise completely different ethical issues. For instance, there is personal information, which is a totally different question. The information I'm talking about here is not personal and is being made available to various numbers of people. If you wanted to talk with me about what was happening between you and your sweetheart and said, would I please not tell anybody, that I could agree to, because that's not generally useful technical information. At least it probably isn't. Now, I could imagine that you might reveal to me a wonderful new sex technique, and I might then feel a moral duty to pass this on to some people who might have a chance to make use of it. But if you were just going to talk with me about the usual soap opera stuff, you know, who hurt whose feelings and what that one did in response and so on, you know, other people don't need to know those details of your soap opera in order to live their lives. They've got their own soap operas. So it's legitimate for me to keep those kinds of personal details private for somebody. But when it comes to generally useful technical information, the stuff of science and technology, the mission of these fields is to develop useful information for people to use. If we withhold it instead, we are betraying the mission of our field. And after some years of thought, I came to the conclusion that this is wrong, and that this was something that I must never do, that no one should do. But during those same years, a series of blows fell on my community and wiped it out. Perhaps the final blow was when Digital discontinued the PDP-10 computer. You see, the incompatible timesharing system was written starting in the 60s, so of course it was written in assembler language for the PDP-10. When the PDP-10 was discontinued, 15 years of our work turned into dust and blew away. Now that's a heavy blow in itself, but its consequences were much worse. Because at that point, all the operating systems for modern computers were proprietary, and you had to sign a non-disclosure agreement even to get the binaries. And most people had no chance, no possibility at all to get the source code. This meant that I could not continue working in my field in the way I had been doing it before. That depended on having a community of people to cooperate with and a body of free software to use and extend. Both of them were gone. And that meant I faced a moral dilemma. What was I going to do? The obvious thing to do was to accept that the world had changed and adapt myself to it, to be the reasonable man. This would have meant using non-free software, signing non-disclosure agreements, and most likely developing non-free software as well. I thought about that and realized that that way I could have fun programming and make money. But at the end, I would look back and say, I have spent my career building walls to divide people, and I would be ashamed of everything I had done. So I realized that if I took the obvious option, I would have a sad life with nothing to be proud of. So I looked for some other option, and it was easy to find one. I could leave the computer field and do something else. This appears to fall into a mental gap for many programmers. They find it unimaginable that they could do something other than programming. Well, they're going to have to start thinking about it now when you look at how many programmers there are out of work. But in any case, they used to say to me, if I don't do this, this, and this to get work as a programmer, I'll starve. Well, even in the U.S., there are millions of people who don't work as programmers. And most of them are not starving. I had no other particular noteworthy skills, but I'm sure I could have been a waiter. Not at a fine restaurant, I suppose. But I could have been a waiter somewhere. Now, there are two things to note about being a waiter. As a waiter, you're not doing anything wrong, unless you're working at McDonald's. And as a waiter, you're not going to starve. Think about it. Except perhaps if you're working at McDonald's. Many people don't realize that the success of McDonald's is due to a misunderstanding on the part of poorly educated Americans. They heard the term fast food, and they thought that fast meant rapid. They didn't realize that fast meant not eating. The purpose of McDonald's food is not to be eaten. It's meant to help you fast. The idea is that if you are fasting, perhaps because it's Yom Kippur or Ramadan or whatever, but you're feeling hungry and you're tempted to eat, you think about that McDonald's food and you lose your appetite. So if anyone ever suggests to you that you should actually eat at McDonald's, now you know why how to explain why you should bring your own food. Anyway, there's one other thing you might do that's unethical as a waiter. You might serve somebody Coke. Participate, please, in the boycott of Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola murders union organizers and continues to do so in Colombia with the help of right-wing death squads supported by the U.S. government and the European Union and various others. But in any case, that boycott didn't exist 20 years ago when I was thinking about these things. So I had found an ethical way to cope with the situation I was in, and that makes a big difference, because you can justify doing something unethical if it's to avoid something worse. You know, if you're really going to die in short order if you don't make some non-free software, I think that excuses it. But I had found a way I could survive. I didn't have an excuse like that anymore. But it was clear to me that being a waiter would be no fun at all, and that it would be a waste of my skills as an operating system developer. Wasting your skill is nowhere near as bad as misusing it. To develop non-free software is misuse of the skill. Wasting it is better, but not good. So for those two reasons, I decided to look for some other thing I could do. Was there something I could do that would use my skills as an operating system developer in a positive way that would make the world a better place? And I realized that operating system development was exactly what was needed to try to correct the problem that I was in. The moral dilemma existed for me and for any computer user because all the operating systems for modern computers were proprietary. So if some operating system developer or developers were to write another operating system and say to everyone, you are free to share this, this would give everybody a way out of the dilemma. I realized that this was probably the most important thing I'd ever have a chance to try to do in my life. And I concluded that I had been elected by circumstances to undertake this job. I was aware of the problem, and hardly anyone was paying any attention to it. I had the skills necessary to try to solve this problem, and probably no one was going to do it if I did not. It's as if you saw someone drowning and you knew how to swim, and it's not Bush, then you've got a duty to save that person. Well, I don't know how to swim, but I do know how to write code. And in this case, writing software was the work that had to be done. So I decided that I would write a free software operating system or die trying, presumably of old age. Because at the time, free software had no enemies. There was nobody trying to stop us from developing a free operating system. It's just that we had a lot of work to do. And it wasn't clear at the time if we would ever get it all done. This decision led to other decisions, technical design decisions. What kind of system should it be? Well, I had just seen one free operating system turn into dust and blow away because it was written for a specific kind of computer architecture which became obsolete. I didn't want to write another system and have the same thing happen. So I decided this system would have to be portable. Now, I knew of just one successful portable operating system, and that was Unix. Furthermore, Unix had some good ideas by the standards of the day, things like pipes and redirection of input and output, the powerful shell programming, the fork and exec system calls that were simple enough people really used them. So I decided to follow the design of Unix. Further, I realized that users don't like incompatible changes. If I had taken all the ideas that from the systems that I'd worked on that I liked, plus my own pet ideas, I could have developed my dream operating system. But then I knew what would happen if I showed that to the users. They would have said, well, this is very nice, but we've written our software for Unix and trained our users to run Unix. It would be too much work to switch, so we won't bother. At that point, I would have had a ready-made excuse. I could have said, I offered them liberty, and they didn't take it. It's their fault. But I wanted to make more than just an excuse. I wanted to make a community which would have people living in it in freedom. So I decided I should make this system compatible with Unix, upward compatible. To add additional features was fine, but the things people had already learned to do, which worked on Unix, had better keep working. Now, Unix consists of many components that communicate with each other through interfaces that were more or less documented, and the users used those interfaces too. So to be compatible with Unix meant replacing each component in a compatible way. And that meant that all the initial design decisions were already made. The remaining design decisions were within one component, and they could be made later by whoever wrote that component of the system. There was just one design decision I had to make, which was what range of computers would we support? Unix had been written to run on 16-bit computers. And because of their small address space, it's a lot of extra work. I said, other people were saying that it would be such a big job that we'd never finish. Well, I decided to make it easier by not supporting 16-bit computers. I figured that it would take several years to get a system finished. And by that time, everybody would be using 32-bit computers. So I said, we'll only support the 32-bit and better computers. That way we didn't have to worry about small address spaces. Made the job easier. And that prediction, it's one of the rare times I've ever tried to make a prediction about technology, turned out to be accurate. So the only thing I needed before I could start the project was a name. Now, to be a hacker means to enjoy playful cleverness. And we, the programmers in the community that had died, we were there because we loved exercising playful cleverness while we wrote software, and in other areas of life as well. And there was a hacker tradition that when you were writing a program similar to some existing program, and this is something that was very often necessary back in the days before portable programming. You know, there was a nice program, but it ran on some other kind of computer, and the only way you could have those features on your computer was to write another program. So there was a hacker tradition that when you did that, you could give it a name that was a recursive acronym, saying that your program is not the other program. For instance, in the 60s and 70s, there were many similar text editors called TECO. Many different computer systems had a TECO, and many of them were called this or that TECO. But one clever hacker called his program TINT, for TINT is not TECO. And we thought that was funny. So then in 1975, I developed the first Emacs text editor, the programmable extensible text editor. You could reprogram it in the middle of an editing session. And this was really exciting, so people wrote imitations of Emacs for many other systems. And some of them were called something or other Emacs, but one was called Fine, for Fine is not Emacs. And there was Sine, for Sine is not Emacs. And Ina, for Ina is not Emacs. And Mince, for Mince is not complete Emacs. And Ina was mostly rewritten to make version 2, which was released as Zwei, which stood for Zwei was Ina initially. So I was going to make a system that was similar to Unix, but not Unix. I looked for a recursive, but all those four-letter combinations in English are not words. And if it doesn't have some other meaning, it's not funny. So I thought, what can I do? I better try some other way. I'll make a contraction. So that way I could make a three-letter recursive acronym, and I tried substituting letters. ANU, BNU, KNU, DNU, ENU, FNU, GNU. Well, GNU is the funniest word in the English language. So that had to be the name. If you can call something GNU, how can you resist? Of course, the reason why the word GNU is used for so much humor is, according to the dictionary, it's pronounced GNU. And so people started asking each other, hey, what's GNU? But nowadays, there's a new answer. You can answer, GNU's not Unix. And the best part is, it sounds like you are obnoxiously telling the person what it's not instead of what it is. But the fact is, you're telling the person exactly what it is. That's the one correct answer. In any case, when you're talking about our operating system, please do not follow the dictionary. Please pronounce it GNU. If you talk about the new operating system, you'll get people very confused. We've been working on it for 20 years, So it's not new anymore. But it still is and always will be GNU, no matter how many people call it Linux by mistake. So we had a name we could start work. I quit my job at MIT to begin writing pieces of the GNU system. I had to quit my job because if I had remained an MIT employee, MIT could have claimed to own the code I was writing and released it as proprietary software products. I didn't want to take even a chance that that might happen because that would ruin everything. It would be better to not write the software at all than let it become just a tool for dividing and subjugating people. By quitting my job, I took MIT out of the equation. However, the head of the AI lab was nice enough to let me keep using the facilities, so I began using a Unix at MIT to start writing these pieces of the GNU system. This was the first time I ever used Unix. I was not a Unix user before that. I chose to follow the design of Unix for the reason that I told you, reasoning exactly like that, in 1983. It was at this moment in 1984 that I actually got to see what using Unix was like. And fortunately, although I saw a few annoyances, they weren't too bad. So I decided to continue with the plan of following the design of Unix and being upward compatible with Unix. This is important to note because there are some people who attribute the development of GNU to some changes in AT&T licensing policy that had taken place some years before that. But the fact is Unix was never free software and I wasn't using it anyway. So I didn't even know about those things. They are irrelevant. The first things I developed were programs, usually fairly small, that were going to be essential for the system, but were of no particular interest to anybody yet. However, at the time, I thought that we would, meaning I plus whoever I could convince to help, that we would develop all these pieces and make a complete system, and then people would start using it. But that's not what happened. In September 84, I began developing GNU Emacs, which was my second implementation of the extensible text editor. And by early 85, it was working well enough that I could use it for all my editing. At this point, some other people started using it too, and the word got around. People started asking me for copies. They wanted to run GNU Emacs on their Unix machines. Of course, I was glad to share it with them, but that meant I had to work out the details of how to distribute these pieces of the GNU system, GNU programs, as we call them. Of course, I put a copy in the FTP server directory. That way, people on the internet could get copies. But in 1985, most programmers, even in the US, were not on the internet. So I was getting plenty of requests from people saying, how can I get a copy? Could you mail me a tape? Well, I could have said to them, I want to spend my time writing more components of the GNU system, not writing tapes. So find a friend who's on the internet who can download it and put it on tape for you. But I had no job. In fact, I've never had a job since January 1984. So I was looking for some way I could make money through my work on free software. So I announced to them, send me $150 and I'll mail you a tape of GNU Emacs. And the orders began to dribble in. By the middle of the year, they were trickling in. I was getting 8 to 10 orders per month. And if necessary, I could have lived on that, because I have always made a practice of living cheaply. I live like a student. And the reason for this is I regard expensive habits as a trap. Most Americans I don't know, this may not be quite as surprising an idea here, but most Americans, if they make this much money, they look for how to spend this much. So they start buying houses and cars and boats and planes and rare stamps and artwork and adventure travel and children. All sorts of expensive habits. They go out and take on expensive habits. And then they find that they have to desperately spend all of their time making the money to pay for these habits, and they have no time to enjoy any of those things, which is especially sad in the case of the children. The other things, I suppose, can get repossessed. But if you do that, then you become a puppet of whoever has money. But if you resist the expensive habits, then you get to choose what you're going to do with your life. You can do something that matters to you instead of what somebody else decides to tell you to do. So I strongly recommend that. Say no to the expensive habits just for the sake of reducing the amount of your life that's under the control of somebody else with money. But people used to say to me, what do you mean it's free software if it costs $150? It took me a few years to recognize that it was important to distinguish two different meanings of the word free. One meaning refers to price, and another meaning refers to freedom. When we speak of free software, we're referring to freedom, not price. So think of free speech, not free beer. Some of those of the users of GNU Emacs got their copies from me through the internet and did not pay me. For them, it was gratis. Some got their copies from me on a tape and paid me. For them, it was paid for. Other users got their copies not from me, but from somebody else who already had a copy. Maybe they got it gratis, maybe they paid for it. I don't know. It was between them and they didn't have to tell me. So Emacs was gratis for some users and paid for some users, but it was free software for all of them because all of them had certain essential freedoms which define free software. So let me now give you the definition of free software. A program is free software for you, a particular user, if you have the following four freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program for any legitimate purpose as you see fit. Freedom one is the freedom to help yourself by studying the source code and then changing it to do what you want. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor by distributing copies to others. And freedom three is the freedom to help build your community by publishing an improved version so others can get the benefit of your changes. All of these freedoms are essential. If any of them is not entirely substantially there, the program is not free software and you should not use it. But why are these the freedoms that matter? Freedom, too, is necessary so that you can live an upright, ethical life. Freedom, too, is the freedom to help your neighbor. If you use a program that denies you freedom, too, then you are in a position where you can find yourself in a moral dilemma at any moment when somebody says to you, "That's a nice program. Could I have a copy?" At that moment, you're going to have to choose between two evils. One evil is to make a copy for that person and violate the license, and the other evil is to comply with the license but be a bad neighbor. Now, I think you should choose the lesser evil, which is to break the license and make a copy for the person. But once you have recognized that using this program means you're liable to face a choice between two evils at any moment, what you should really do is not be in that situation. You should not be using that program. You shouldn't have that program. And this is why to be a user of a non-free program is in itself participating in the unethical scheme, the unethical antisocial system of non-free software. If you're going to be a good neighbor without having to do it underground and without having to do it through lies, the way to do it is say no to the non-free software. And that, of course, is the whole purpose of developing the GNU system, so that you've got an alternative to go to make it easy for you to say no. The most important resource of any society is the spirit of goodwill, the willingness to help your neighbor. This is not a physical resource, it's a psychosocial resource. But it's no less important for all that. It's no coincidence that the world's major religions have been promoting this spirit of goodwill very explicitly for thousands of years, because the level of this resource can vary to a certain extent, and a little bit more of it makes life better for everyone. So we must try to organize society to encourage this spirit of goodwill. What does it mean, therefore, when powerful social institutions start saying that it's wrong to share with your neighbor? They are poisoning this vital resource, something no society can afford. And what does it mean when they say that if you share with your neighbor, you're a pirate? They are trying to equate helping your neighbor with attacking a ship. That's morality turned upside down. Attacking ships is very, very bad, but helping your neighbor is something we should encourage. And what does it mean when they establish harsh punishments for anyone caught helping her neighbor? How much fear is it going to take before everyone's too scared to help each other? Do you want this terror campaign to go on in your society? I hope not. I hope that you will demand an end to these punishments, that you will demand that your government choose a side, the publishers or the public, and make it clear that they can't be on both sides at once. So that is freedom number two. The freedom to help your neighbor, which is necessary so that we can live an upright, ethical life while using a computer. Freedom zero, the freedom to run the program, is necessary for a different reason, so that you can control your own computer. If you are restricted in when or how much you can run a certain program, obviously, you're not using your computer freely. But freedom zero is not enough, because that's just the freedom to have your computer do whatever it is that the program is already set up to do. To be free and in control of your own computer, you mustn't be limited to that. You've got to have the freedom to change the program so that you can decide what it's going to do. That requires freedom one, the freedom to study the source code and then change it to do what you want. Without this, the developer of the program controls what you can do on your computer. You can't even, without this freedom, you can't even tell what the program really is doing. And many developers of non-free software take advantage of this by introducing malicious features. Very often, non-free software spies on you. Such a common software package as Microsoft Windows spies on you. When you do a search through your own files for a certain word or string, Windows sends a message to Microsoft saying what you searched for. And when Windows XP asks for an upgrade, it reports to Microsoft what software you have installed on your computer. Now, it does it sends this information encrypted so that it wasn't easy for people to determine that it was being sent. But some people reported they had done some careful, complicated studies to figure out that Windows was indeed sending this information when it asked for an upgrade. Now, this is noteworthy because several years ago there was a scandal when Microsoft had set it up so that Windows would report what software was on your disk. And there was enough scandal that they took it out. And then what we see is that they put it back in without telling anybody in such a way that people wouldn't notice. But lest you think that spyware is limited to Windows, I should point out that Windows Media Player also spies on you. It reports whatever you look at. But Microsoft is far from the only developer that puts in malicious features. RealPlayer spies on you in the same way. That probably is where they got the idea from. The TiVo spies on you too. People were excited about the TiVo because it uses some free software, but it also contains non-free software. And some of that non-free software is designed to spy on you. So the mere fact that something contains some free software doesn't mean it's good. The question that matters is, does it contain any non-free software? In other words, does it entirely respect your freedom? That's the question to ask. But the malicious features of non-free software are not limited to spying on you. Sometimes non-free programs are specifically designed to fail to work. They're designed so that they won't view a certain document or won't let you apply a certain operation. This is called DRM, Digital Restrictions Management. And you've got to beware of this. It can get nastier. Some non-free software packages are designed to reconfigure your computer, for instance, to make it start displaying advertisements in an annoying way. And they figure that you won't know which packages are going to do that, so you won't be able to avoid them. And they figure you won't know how to undo what they did. By the way, there are several chairs available here. Please come in and sit down in a comfortable place, if there's no specific reason why you mustn't. They get stranger than that. For instance, the music sharing program Kazaa is designed to sell time on your computer. A client can pay to run his programs on your computer, but he doesn't pay you. He pays the developers of Kazaa. And the developers of Kazaa did not inform the users that their computers would be used in this way. But when it was found out and they were confronted, they said, look at our license. It gives us permission to do almost anything, including this. And it can get much nastier. It can go as far as actual back doors. For instance, Windows XP has a back door. When it asks for an upgrade, it says who you are. Microsoft is checking that you're authorized to use it and that your computer is authorized to use it. And so they can send you an upgrade meant just for you. This upgrade might contain anything. It might contain another account they can log in on. It might just not run at all. And you have essentially no recourse. That's the backdoor that Microsoft knows about and that we know about. There might be other backdoors. For instance, I was told in India that some programmers working on Windows XP had been arrested and accused of putting in another backdoor for Al-Qaeda to use. Well, I guess that attempt did not succeed, but was there another that did? The fact is that we are all helpless if we use software that doesn't give us freedom one. There's no way we can tell what it really does. There's no way we can tell what malicious features it might or might not have. But that's not as, but our helplessness goes beyond that. You see, not all developers of non-free software put in malicious features, but they're all human. So they all make mistakes. They develop features thinking they'll be useful, and then they turn out to be inconvenient. Or they make coding errors, which we call bugs. And you're helpless against these two. There's nothing you can do to change these features. We, the developers of free software, are human too. We also make mistakes. We write features that you don't like. We make errors in the code, and so our programs have bugs. The difference is that we are not keeping you helpless. So if you don't like our decisions, you can change them. You're not the prisoner of our software, whereas you are the prisoner of a non-free program that doesn't give you freedom. One, we do not try to make you the prisoner of our decisions, whereas they do. But freedom one is not enough. Freedom one is the freedom to personally study the source code and change it to do what you want. There are millions of people who use computers and don't know how to program. For them, freedom one is not of any direct practical use. But even for us programmers, freedom one is not enough because there's too much software. There's no way that anybody can read and master all of the free software even, so as to make all the changes he wants personally. The only way we can effectively exercise control over our own computers is if we work together doing it. And that means we need freedom three, the freedom to help build your community, the freedom to publish a modified version so others can get the benefit of your changes. Freedom three means that people can work together developing the program in the direction that they jointly want. That means we're not limited to the changes that we personally can write. And it means that the people who don't know how to program can get the benefit of having some control over which way the program develops. Because even if you don't know how to write a line of code, you can still choose between two versions. If the original version had some bad feature you didn't that was malicious or just annoying, and somebody else makes a modified version which doesn't have that feature or has some other feature that you like better, you'll choose that version. In fact, just about everybody will choose that version. The original version will probably just get forgotten. And so everyone has together participated in choosing which way this program is going to develop, including the millions who can't write a line of code themselves. And so we have software that develops under the democratic control of society. Even those who can't personally participate in writing the code can participate in choosing which way it should go. Suppose that, and this doesn't necessarily have to go in one direction alone. You know, if there are two groups of users with different desires, then there can be two versions that develop to satisfy both of these groups of users. And that's the way it should be. Suppose that there are a million people who want a certain change in a program. Well, just by luck, there would be 10,000 of them that know how to program. So sooner or later, a few of them will make that change. And with Freedom 3, they can publish the modified version. And then all of those million people will see that modified version and choose it. So they'll all get what they want. And this is without their having found each other in advance. These million users have a common desire, need not have identified each other and got together in advance. They can still take advantage of the change once it's done. But they can get together in advance if that suits their purposes. Suppose there are 1,000 users who want a certain change, and none of them knows how to program. They can put up notices and make contact with each other and form an organization where they will all put in money. So, for instance, if each one put in $100, they would have $100,000. That's enough to pay some programmers to do a substantial amount of work. So this organization can go around before it decides how much money to collect from each member. It can go to various programming companies and say, how much will you charge to make this change, and when can you have it done? And if they don't like the answer from the first company, they can go to another company and ask the same questions, which illustrates the fact that free software brings with it a free market for all sorts of support. Proprietary software usually means a monopoly for support, because only the developers have the source code. A very large example of this is the X Window system, which was developed at MIT in the late 80s and released by MIT under a license that gave you all these freedoms. So if you got MIT's version under MIT's license, then it was free software for you. But among those who got this were various computer manufacturers that distributed Unix systems. They made the necessary changes in X to get it to run on their platforms. And then they compiled it to get the binaries, and they put these binaries into their Unix system. And they distributed to their customers just the binaries under the same non-disclosure agreement as they used for all the rest of Unix. Large numbers of users got copies of X in that way. And for them, it was not free software at all. They didn't even have one of those. Well, they had the freedom to run it, most likely, except in some cases where they were restricted as to how many users could log in at once. So some of them didn't even have Freedom Zero. Now, this made a paradoxical situation. If you ask the question, is the X Window system free software or not, the answer depended on where you made the measurement. If you made the measurement coming out of the development group, you'd say, here I observe all four freedoms, it's free software. If you made the measurement among the users, you'd say, most of the users don't have these freedoms, it's not free software. The developers of X did not intend to spread freedom to computer users. That wasn't their goal. They wanted to have a professional success. As far as they were concerned, those probably millions of copies of non-free versions of X were part of their success. But the reason for developing GNU was specifically to give computer users freedom. And if that had happened to GNU, that would have been failure. So I looked for some way to prevent that problem. And the method I developed is called copyleft. Here's how it works. Legally speaking, it's based on copyright. We use copyright law, but instead of using it to divide and restrict people, we use it to protect people from being divided and restricted. To copyleft a program, first we put on the copyright notice, which legally isn't necessary anymore, but reminds people that under copyright law it would be prohibited to copy or modify or distribute this program. But then we say, you're authorized to copy and distribute this program. You're authorized to make modified and extended versions. And you're authorized to distribute them too. But there is a condition. And this condition is the reason why we go to all this trouble. The condition says, any modified or extended version that you distribute, any program you distribute that contains any substantial part of this, must as a whole be released under these same conditions, no more or no and no less, and it must be available as source code. And that way, we make sure that the people who get the modified version from you get the same freedom from you that you got from us. In effect, we make sure that the freedom reaches every user. The freedom goes wherever the software goes by saying that people are not allowed to put themselves in the middle and strip off the freedom and pass along just the software. In other words, forbidding is forbidden is the basic logic of copyleft. Copyright is normally used for a right-wing purpose, which is keep people divided and helpless to take their money. Copyleft, of course, flips it over and serves a left-wing purpose of protecting everyone's freedom and encouraging cooperation. Nobody is specifically required to cooperate with anybody else in any particular way. If you have a copy of a free program, you're not required to ever make a copy or distribute it to somebody else. That's your choice. You're not required to ever change it, but you can if you want. And if you've changed it, you're not required to publish that. You don't have to distribute a copy of your changed version, but you can if you want to. What copyleft says is that if you do distribute a copy of your changed version, you must respect the freedom of the person that you distribute it to. So you can't try to use our code to divide other people and keep them helpless. So, during the 1980s, our work was to develop the various pieces that we needed to have a complete GNU operating system. A lot of this work was done by volunteers, but starting in October 85, we founded the Free Software Foundation, whose mission is to raise money and use it to promote free software. One of the things we did in the 80s was hire people to write free software, and we're still doing that to some extent now. So some important pieces of the GNU system, such as the GNU C library and the command interpreter or shell, which we call Bash, the born-again shell, were developed by staff of the FSF. But many important pieces were developed by volunteers. Eventually, we developed the GNU task list. When we had more than half of the system, when it was shorter to list what was missing than to list what we had, we wrote down a list of what was missing. Initially, it was a list of pieces of Unix that we hadn't replaced yet. Now, we still have a task list. You can find it on savannah.gnu.org, which is our development hosting site. But now it's a list of some ways to extend the system and some application programs we would like to have. So there's still work to be done. But in the early 90s, the system was almost complete. We had all the essential components except one, which was the kernel. Now, I was always looking for shortcuts. I figured to develop a complete operating system doesn't mean we have to write every single piece ourselves. If somebody else will develop a piece, some program that could be useful in GNU, and it's free software, then we should use it. That will help us get to the goal of being able to use computers in freedom sooner. For instance, I wanted GNU to have a Windows system. I had actually developed a couple of Windows systems while working for MIT in around 1980. So as soon as I started GNU, of course I wanted it to have a Windows system, but that wasn't something we worked on. And then I saw the X Windows system and I figured, okay, we won't have to write our own Windows system, we'll just use X. It's true X was not copylefted, but the MIT version was free software, and so we could use it. When people develop free software but they don't apply the technique of copyleft, what they're doing is still good. It's still, you know, they are respecting your freedom. They're not taking it away. They could do even better. They could use copyleft and help protect your freedom from third parties. And usually I think that would be better. But what they are doing is not unethical. They are not taking away your freedom. And the software is free and can be used. So I decided, rather than developing another window system ourselves, it would be much better if we just used X. So we started changing other parts of GNU to run, to work together with X. And so by the early 90s, the only missing piece was the kernel. Now, I had been hoping to find some way I could get I could either get a kernel that was partly what we needed so we could change it, or get part of the kernel. And I found out about a funded project at Carnegie Mellon called Mach, which is a microkernel, or at least we often call it a microkernel, because it doesn't provide all the facilities of a Unix kernel. The idea is that some of those facilities will be implemented by user space programs. So we were going to have to write those user space programs to run on top of Mach. And we started doing that in 1990. I thought that this way we could get a kernel running quicker. But it didn't turn out that way. It actually took many years to get this collection of user space programs to work. And then we had to take over the maintenance of Mach itself. Fortunately, we didn't have to wait for that. Because in 1991, a college student in Finland developed his own kernel using the old-fashioned monolithic design, and he got it barely working in less than a year, which is pretty good work. Now, initially, this kernel, which was called Linux, was not free software. But in 1992, he relicensed it under the GNU General Public License, which is the copyleft license that I wrote. So that's one way of making something free software. At that point, it was possible to take Linux and fit it into the gap in the GNU system and make a complete system that was free software. And people did that. This combined GNU plus Linux system then started to catch on. But at that time, a confusion happened, and people started calling the entire system Linux, with the result that the tens of millions of users often think that everything was started in 1991 by a Finnish college student. Now, this has some bad consequences. You see, it doesn't matter so much if people know who really did the system, but it's very important for people to know why. When people think that the whole system is Linux, and they think that it was started by Lee, why he wrote that kernel? He was trying to have fun and learn. Now, these are perfectly good motivations, especially motivations for writing something that's a contribution to society. But they would not have been enough to get us where we are now. And they were not the real motivation for the development of the GNU plus Linux system. People who look to Linus Torvalds for ethical leadership will find that he doesn't give them very much. He doesn't like to criticize practices of anybody. He thinks that non-free software licenses are legitimate. He's been developing non-free software until a couple of years ago in his job, and he's currently using non-free software in a very public way for the development of Linux, the kernel, and inviting other people to use it with him. So he sets a really terrible example for the community. And the thing is, this example carries more weight because people think he started it all. The fact is that the reason we have a free operating system, an entire one, is because of people who were determined to live in freedom and to reject software that divides you and keeps you helpless. In other words, for people who say that non-free software is ethically bad. That's what people need to know. And that's why I ask you to call the system GNU/Linux or GNU plus Linux. Help correct this error. Help inform people where the system really came from. Because then when they read about the GNU project and they see what we have to say, they'll realize it has something to do with them. People who think of themselves as Linux users when they see what the GNU project says, the philosophy I've been telling you today, they're likely to think, that's got nothing to do with me, I'm a Linux user. If only they knew that the system they are calling Linux is really the GNU system, they might recognize that what we have to say has some relationship to their lives. And they will say, your philosophy is so idealistic, it must be impractical. And there they are using the system, which is the practical result of our idealism. If you want to achieve something very big, you better either have a lot of money or idealism. With idealism, you can keep on working towards the goal till you get there. Otherwise, you'll just forget about it and drift away. There's nothing more practical than idealism. And sometimes they say something really ironic. They say, this emphasis on freedom is a mistake because it interferes with the success of Linux. They're not just confused about what Linux is, they're confused about what success is, too. They think success is popularity. And they think that the operating system is Linux. Well, I mean, I'm glad if the GNU system becomes more popular. That does make my ego feel good. But even I can recognize that the success of this particular operating system is not the ultimate goal. We shouldn't focus solely on making this operating system more popular. I mean, I'm glad if it does get more popular, but there's something beyond that, and that is your freedom and mine. That is to be able to live in a society where we are free to cooperate with each other. And if I, despite the temptation of giving into my ego, can recognize that, there's no excuse for anybody else to fail to recognize it. So you've got to spread the word. We're aiming for something beyond just success for our technical work. And, you know, often, in most cases, more users is good for us. More users of free software means more people having some freedom. All else being equal, that's good. But there are cases where all else is not equal, and we've got to be on the lookout for that. We mustn't forget the goal of freedom. History shows us that people who don't value freedom